it straight down the middle. Then it started to...
You won a couple of times in 1974, starting in January at the Andy Williams San Diego Open.
Andy Williams San Diego Open, yeah, it was... Yep, I remember that. San Diego seemed to be doing pretty good for me.
You were Mr. Consistency that week, shooting rounds of 69, 69, 68, 69.
Uh-huh.
And you beat a pretty, you also beat a pretty good player that year, too. Probably one of the greatest swingers of a golf club that ever lived, Gene Littler.
Oh, yeah, I know you were going to say Gene Littler. Gene the machine. Yeah, there's no doubt. You're right, Bruce. He was one of the best. No doubt.
Yeah, what a beautiful golf swing. And the other guy that was won back, too, was Rod Curl, as I remember.
He was
the first full-blooded Native American on tour, as I remember.
That's right. He was. He probably was. But one thing I remember about Gene, not only about his golf swing, but I looked at his hands. He had the best looking pair of hands you've ever. I don't say best looking. Well, I guess for me it was best looking. They were just, they looked like they were out of a mold. Just perfect. Big, thick. And when he put them on a golf club, I mean, it looked like they were molded. They were just so perfect. And that's the way it is. And even in his putting, it was like, I never will forget. Every time I watched Gene play, I always looked at his hands because they mesmerized me or something. It's amazing.
Well, you guys always do talk about going back to basics, don't you, in terms of fundamentals?
Mm-hmm. I think because, you know, really when you stop and think about it, what else have you got to contact with a golf club other than your hands? Yeah. So if your hands don't have any feel, you're not going to do too well. You gotta have feel in those hands and feel the golf swing. I mean, it just works hand in hand. And if you got a good pair of hands like Gene Littler had, I mean, not too many people have.
So, Bobby, to finish off the victories on the regular tour for you, you won the Canadian Open again with a, you know, what a consistency that week was, 67, 67, 68, 68. And you beat John Schlee and Larry Ziegler by four shots.
Larry Ziegler, yeah. Yeah, that was funny. It was, Mississauga. It was they're in Toronto.
Great old club.
Yeah, that's right. It was. It had a lot of tournaments, but it rained all that week before. It was really saturated, and luckily it quit raining, and we got the tournament off and got it finished.
Bobby, back then that tournament was like a major, wasn't
it?
Well, it was considered. If for example, if Bruce wins two majors,
Canadian Open winner would go in.
Was the first alternate.
Well, let's talk about 1975 because that was an important year in your career. Not in a good way, but having lived just a few miles away from Butler National. In Oak Brook, Illinois. I remember this one like it was yesterday as well. This is the 1975 Western Open, and it came just a week after the U.S. Open was contested at Medina. That's when Lou Gramm won. But tell us about that week.
Oh, boy. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but it was I remember I was playing with Bob Dixon and Tony Jacklin. And we were going up the fourth fairway of Butler National, and it was going up the hill into the right, left of the green was a big, huge lake. And on the other side of the lake was the 13th tee green.
Yeah, that's a good downhill par three, and then 14 about goes around the lake right to left.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you're familiar with it, right?
Oh,
right.
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, as in Chicago, there's a lot of times it would be overcast. You wouldn't pay a whole lot of attention. But this particular day it was overcast, and still we weren't paying a whole lot of attention to it. Nothing had happened. And all of a sudden, crack went across the skies. I mean, it sounded like the end of the world. It was so loud and cracked. What I think happened, I have no idea what really happened. It must have hit the lake, because when that happened, I was on the ground, and when I looked up, my guy was carrying the sign. The sign was looked like it was fluttering through the air.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Pete. I forgot Pete's last name, but God, it's been so long ago. Anyway, I got up, I started running because I was hysterical. I didn't know what had happened. It was really weird. And I don't know if I was in my right mind or what, but anyways, I started running and I was running, and finally I ran there was a tent at the end of the fourth fairway, the fourth green. And we went in there, and that's where I went in, and I sat down, and I got my breath, and I tasted like something had been like a charcoal in my mouth. I thought, what? That's kind of weird. The taste in my mouth was kind of, I guess, you know, I was going like this. Anyways, I was sitting there. And doctor came over, and he looked at me, and he says, Bobby, are you all right? And I said, well, I guess so. He looked up, and he said, look up at me. So I looked up at him, and he looked around. He said, come on, we're going to the hospital. So they took me to Hinsdale Hospital there, and they put me under a 48-hour with all these gadgets in my head, body, and everything. You are familiar with that. Anyway, I did there for 2 days, and I didn't realize that Jerry Hurd and Lee Trevino were also the same way in another part of the hospital. It was weird how it happened.
Bob, if we look back, Bobby, that was the one incident that happened on the PGA Tour that forced the tour to start monitoring storms that were coming towards the golf course. Because remember I was actually standing on a tee and saw Jerry Hurd and Lee Trevino get knocked over by the lightning.
Did you really?
It was scary as hell. I thought, you know, the lady scorer and the boy scorer with them too. They all got knocked down. Yeah, it was shocking.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
That's weird how that lightning, what it does. It's hard to explain when it does happen. You say, what was that? Or something. You realize it's it just happens, and you wonder how it happens. Oh, it's like you say, God, it's scary.
So, Bobby, take us through the aftermath of that. You spent a couple of days in the hospital, observation, obviously had some effect of that. Was it just not the same after that?
Oh, I don't know if it really affected me long term. It may have in some ways, but I don't know. I can't recall any particular incident that may have been because of the lightning itself. No, I think I'm okay as far as the aftermath. I hope so. My wife says, well, he's more electrifying. Whether that's good or bad, but anyways, we don't. I don't think it really bothers affected me long term, but it could have. But I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, we had a chance to talk about your 12 triumphs on the PGA Tour. Let's just touch on major championship experience. We talked obviously about the PGA, but as I look at your major championship record, the thing that really impresses me, and again, I mentioned this to Bruce before we came on, I don't know if you remember this, but you made 36 of your first 38 cuts in major championships.
Pretty good, Bobby.
That is. That's better. I didn't know it was that good. That's nice to hear good things like that.
I don't remember seeing a better record in the first 38 events. I'd have to go back through the guys we've talked to, but that's pretty impressive.
That's nice. I never realized that.
Well, what's your remembrances of the Masters?
The best I played was in 70 when I finished second to Gay in
1967.
It seemed like I never conquered those greens. They were always tough to putt, and I just didn't seem like I could get anything going. Although a couple of times, 75 of it had a 67 the first round and a couple of things like that. But one thing about the Masters, and everybody, when the Masters time came around, people would really get excited in the fact that the green, you knew the golf course was going to be in perfect shape and the greens were going to be this. But we weren't used to greens like that until you got to the Masters.
Yeah.
Because all our greens were a lot slower, and Bruce will verify this.
For sure.
Were a lot slower, and they were bumpier, and they were of different grasses. But it seemed like the Masters had this cut close enough to be slick and smooth and whatever else, whereas we never played in greens like that ever. Throughout the year. So it was really it was just special.
Well, 67, you mentioned that was second place by one to Gay Brewer. Brewer, the prior year, had three-putted the last hole.
Yeah, he sure did.
And then lost in a playoff to Jack Nicklaus.
Right.
And then came back and won it the next year.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sure did. I said, why in the heck did you have to three-putt that whole age? You might not have played so well the next year.
Well, and that 67 Masters was Ben Hogan's last Masters as well.
Yes, it were.
You mentioned 1975. That's when you tied fourth. Nicklaus won that year. As you mentioned, first-round leader you were with a 67.
Right.
And then in 1974, you were two back after 54, the year Gary Player won.
Right. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
So you played Augusta National pretty well.
Sometimes, yeah. It was.
But you're right. Those greens were always difficult, Bobby, weren't they?
They were always difficult, man. You really had to. Well, I used to play practice rounds with Kerry Middlecoff. Kerry and I became fairly good friends. When I'd go to the Masters, I'd always ask to contact him and have him or want to be practice round with him. And he would tell me where to place certain holes and stuff. He was really, really helpful. But I'll never forget on the 12th, on par 3, number 12, he said, you know, a lot of people, they always talked about people putting it in the water and costing the tournament and mm-hmm. doing this, doing that, and going for the pin. And when it was in that far right, a small area, and this and that, he says, any day you play this hole, you look at that trap. He said, you play it right over the middle of that trap and don't look left or right.
No flag.
And that's right, and you won't put it in the water.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I never put it in the water on 12. And I never went for the flag, but I never put it in the water.
Yep, yep. Let's touch a little bit on the U.S. Open because you had some good performances there as well. Four top tens, a couple of top fives.
Mm-hmm.
What was probably your best chance to win the U.S. Open?
I think it's that first 63. I was tied with Oakmont. Yeah, that's where it was, Oakmont. And I was tied with Gary and I had played this third round together. And after the third round, we were both tied at 211. And so we're playing off the final group. In those days, we played 36 holes on Sunday. So after the morning round, we broke and had like 30 minutes or 45 minutes for lunch, and that was it. And then you head right back out. So we did that. Now I'm getting ready to go, or we're getting ready to go, and I can't find my caddy. Don't know where the heck he is. He was a young kid, just a local kid. And anyways, one thing, and I never told him anything after I got through the morning round, but I assumed he knew that we had played. Anyway, finally found him under a tree, or a friend of mine found him under a tree eating a sandwich, and he was he had his back to the first tee. And I thought, well, anyway.
He thought he was done
for the day. Yeah, he thought he was done for the day. Anyways, luckily, Gary Player had hit the tee shot, and Joe Dye was the head of the U.S., I mean, head of the PGA then, or USGA.
Yeah, USGA then. Yeah.
And he told me, he said, Bobby, he said, I'm going to have to find you unless you can go. So Gary hit his tee shot, and he walked very slowly off the tee. And he didn't get to his, and luckily the kid showed up before he got to his tee shot or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what the rule was. If he'd hit a second shot, then I think I'd be DQ'd.
Or add two, I think. You might have got two-shot penalty.
Or two-shot penalty, yeah. Right. That might be more
accurate. But you were able to get off in time. Huh?
I was able to get off in time, but then I double bogeyed the first hole, and then I lost by two. I lost by two when I bogeyed the sixth. I bogeyed the 15th. And the 18th.
Mm.
But I finished two shots back.
Yeah, and that was the year 1962 that Jack beat Arnie in a playoff.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Sure was.
Other good finishes at Olympic. Good finish at Oak Hill. Good finish at Marion the year Trevino won.
Oh, yeah. I played with him, man. Let's see, play with the third round, I think it was. Yeah, I remember vividly that.
Yeah. And then in the PGA Championship, I guess Aronimink maybe was your other opportunity there in 1962, where you were sixth when Gary Player won there.
Yeah, I remember Gary won that. Sure do.
And that's the year that that's the year actually that they moved that tournament. It was scheduled to be played in Brentwood Country Club in California, and they moved it to Pennsylvania because California said, "Look, if you PGA are going to continue with your Caucasian only policy," which had just been eliminated, I think, the previous November. And so they actually said, you guys aren't playing here until you get that fixed. Well, they didn't get it fixed in time, and they ended up moving the tournament to Aronimink.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
No, I'd forgotten that too.
Boy.
Ryder Cup, you had a chance to compete in the 1967 victory at Champions Golf Club with the captain, once again, yeah. Ben Hogan comes into your life.
Mr. Hardeville, when we were all together there in the locker room, he was holding court and kind of asking us questions. He was asking us, the entire team sitting in front of him, who would we like to play with as a team? Is there any particular people that we'd like to play with? Well, Johnny Pod spoke up and said, "Well, Bobby and I like to play together because we don't care if we hit it in the woods. We'll go find it and hit it out." And Mr. Hogan looked at him and said, "Okay, can you two be compatible or whatever?" And we said, "Well, yes, sir." And so we said, "Okay, you two play together." And we won all matches. We were four wins and one tie.
Pretty good.
Yeah, you and Billy Casper led the U.S. team with 4.5 points.
Yeah, that's right.
We talked to Al Geiberger last week. Al was on that team with you, wasn't he?
Yeah, he sure was.
And he said Mr. Hogan was pretty efficient with his words in the team speeches.
Yes, he was. Like I said, Mike, he never wasted words, it didn't seem like. He just always right to the point. That was it.
What do you remember about Arnold Palmer and his airplane? That
I've got to tell you. Anyway, we're all out there playing, and Mr. Hogan's out there in a golf cart riding around, watching this and everything. And sure, he was, I don't remember where he was sitting exactly, what hole or whatever. Here comes Arnold. Here comes
with
Arnold.
His jet.
Flying. He's got his jet flying over like this, and he waves his wings like that. And Hogan looks up and don't say anything. It goes back to whatever he was doing, whatever. But I don't recall him saying anything. So the first round of the tournament, now this is a practice round. But anyways, the first round of the tournament, the newspaper there, they got the pairings, and they go down the list, the pairings, and then the other side put their pairings up. So anyways, they were looking at the pairings, and they noticed Mr. Palmer's name is not on there. And they thought, well, how could that be? He's the king, and he's the captain, more or less. And they said, they didn't say a word, and so one of the sports writers asked him, "Mr. Hogan, what happened to Mr. Palmer? How come he's not in the lineup?" And you know what he said? "Just because I said so."
That was it.
"Because I said so."
Yeah, and interesting.
That's all he said. Yep.
That was it.
That was it.
The captain got a chance to pick which ball you guys played.
Oh, yeah, by the way, that's right. What had happened, we were also asking the locker room. When we had the options, you could play the big ball or the little ball, I think they're there. I call it 65 or something. Anyway, Doug spoke up, said, "Mr. Barber, or rather, Mr. Hogan, what ball should we play?" And it took him by surprise. He said, "Well, I don't think that's much of a decision. You can't hit that little ball out of the fairway." Doug said, "Well, I think we can." Well, he said, "But yes," he said, "a small ball would be the thing to do."
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we used a small ball.
He made the call on that.
Yeah, he made the call on that one. Yeah. I think we would have.
You can't hit the little one out of the fairway. I love that. I love it.
He was something.
Well, you came out of your regular tour play and joined the senior tour when you turned age 50. Played the senior tour for 10 years.
Right.
And had a victory at the 1989 Southwestern Bell Classic in a playoff with the Sarge.
That's right.
You lasted 10 years. How did you hold up physically over those 10 years from age 50 to age 60?
Well, some people's bodies, I think we all agree, well, they hold up better because you can see it in a few of the players today that play up until 60, and even in their early 70s. I mean, it's
Bernhard Langer is a great example. Yeah,
that's a good example. Man. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Bernhard is a perfect example. And if your body holds up, like as you can play, I guess, to those golden years or more or less. But my body, after a few things happened when I was growing up with the wreck and a few things, and a few knocks here and there, my body it would hurt. And a lot of guys that my age feel that hurt, but I'm not complaining at all. I just know swinging a golf club is just no fun.
Yeah, tired.
So it just hurt. My hands hurt. My body hurts. My fingers hurt. And I mean, they just don't. Arthritis sets in and just things, it's no fun playing. So if it's no fun playing, there's no sense in playing. Luckily, I didn't have to play after I had my job at Firestone. It was just phenomenal. And playing the senior tour was something that wasn't really something that I look forward to playing, doing, but I played a few years. I'm glad I did, but yeah. It's been a great thing for a lot of good players in the 50 and over group. Sure has. It's been really nice.
So, Bobby, for the last 20 years, you've been involved with the Bobby Nichols Fiddlesticks Charity Foundation, and you've had a pretty good MC that's helped you guys make 20. $15 million in those 20 years. Pretty fancy, boy.
It is. It is pretty fancy. I mean, it's beyond all expectations. I remember Earl Holland, John Gentleman, and Jack Rogers. When we first started in 1980, they said, we'll try to help the kids. Abused and neglected kids is here in Southwest Florida. See if we can't have a tournament. It's our charity that would benefit the local people here, the local charities,
right,
and so forth. And so we decided to do that. And Earl looked at, and Earl's a pretty wealthy guy. And he said, "Well, we don't have any money. Where do we start?" And we all looked at him and said, "Well, we're looking at someone that might get us started." Anyways, he got us started. And it went from $134,000 the first year, I remember, but I don't remember exactly the figures on down through the years. But up until this year, it was 13.5. This year, it raised 1.7.
Nice. Wow. Isn't that great?
That wow. is great. Now we're going to give away $1.5 million, so it'll be $15 million.
That's
that we've
great.
Given away to the abused wow. kids, neglected kids in Southwest Florida.
Good
and
for you.
And we're lucky, Bruce. We don't have anyone on the payroll.
Isn't that great?
No one gets paid.
Yeah.
And no one complains.
And that MC that Bruce alluded to was none other than Johnny Bench.
Johnny huh? Bench, old time.
Old catcher for the Cincinnati big, Red.
Yeah, big red machine.
Yeah.
And he's been with us. I met him in 68, and he was in PEP. And I said, Johnny, would you do something like that? He said, well, right on the right situation. He said, I told him, I said, well, we're going to start this and that. Would you be the MC? He said, well, let's start it and see what happens. And sure enough.
Still there.
After he signed, so he's still there after 20 years.
Isn't that great?
He's come every year. He really does.
What a great legacy that you're leaving with that tournament and that fundraising event.
It really is.
As we wind down with you here, Bobby, there's always a couple of questions that Bruce and I like to ask our guests. Bruce, you want to go first?
Yes, so Bobby, if you knew what you know now when you first started on the tour, what would you have done differently?
Differently, I know for one thing, I would have made a schedule out to where I went and played in the Open a few times. I really am sorry that I didn't fit that in the schedule, but at the time, I just didn't feel like I had the time to go there and have the job at Firestone and be playing for tournaments and so forth. I was trying to Scotty Brubaker, who I answered to, he never ever said anything about how many tournaments I should play in. That he just said, whatever you feel like playing, go play. But he knew, or he's hoping I wouldn't take advantage of him.
Right.
And sure enough, it worked out well. So that would be the number one thing I wish I'd have done, because I miss that. I'd like to have seen what it'd been like. I watched it on television, but it would be, it's not like playing it, that's for sure.
Yeah. So our other question that Bruce and I would have of you, Bobby, is we're going to give you one career mulligan. where would you take it?
That would be a good one. I'd say probably the Masters when I was playing with Gay. The 16th hole there, it's par 5. I put it on in 2 with a 4-iron, and but I didn't get up and down. I didn't put it on. I put it just over the green chip and didn't get it up and down. And I believe if I got that one up and down, by 14, if I could have birdied that one, which I should have, after hitting a second shot on the green, that would be the one mulligan that I can think of. Gosh, off my head, that's be about to, that would be it.
Yeah. Bobby, in closing, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, just to be remembered is all I can ask for. I'm like Bruce. We're just all, both of us are, well, we're from the old school, and we've been to, I might say, different things than they are. So it's hard to explain to today's generation when they don't experience. You got to experience what we've been through.
Yeah.
To say, in the game of golf, not in a physical way, but in a mental way and so forth, what have you.
So, Bobby, Mr. Nichols, I want to personally thank you for joining us today. We've looked forward to chatting with you. I know you've gone through the COVID issue, and Nancy and the two boys have been great. And we thank you for joining us. I know Mike. I know Mike's appreciated it as well, Mike.
Yeah, Bobby, thanks a million for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, and it's been my honor to be on your show. And Bruce and I have always admired Bruce throughout the years and what he's done and what he's been through. So you guys keep up the good work and wish you the best, Mike and Bruce.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Bobby.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.